Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast.
Hi there, welcome to the very latest Andy J Podcast. I really appreciate you downloading. I've got a very special conversation for you this week. And I also have to tell you about next week's as well, because sometimes you just land a double whammy. And I was fortunate to record with two fascinating guests on the same day. The first one is the one you're going to hear today. The next one is the one you hear next week. And I can tell you, I was just bouncing off the walls with delight at these chats, because they are just really great guys and really, really good conversations. So the chat today is with one of my favourite actors. He is a character actor par excellence. He is, of course, the brilliant Timothy Spall. Now, he has been in so many incredible movies, it would be unfair of me to just pick a few. However, I'm going to pick a few. There is, of course, he was Wormtail in the Harry Potter series. And I imagine if you're new to this show, you might be listening because you're a big Harry Potter fan and you want to hear all about it. I can tell you he's not going to disappoint. There are some cracking Harry Potter on the set anecdotes on the way. Then, of course, he was in The Last Samurai and Vanilla Sky with a certain Hollywood legend, Mr. Tom Cruise. And again, he's got some great stories to share about that. Then, of course, he won the 2014, I think it was the Cannes Film Festival, Great Best Actor for Mr. Turner, the Mike Leigh film, for which he was the title character, and many, 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 many more. I think he's done 7 Mike Leigh films. He's also really good company. A few other little Timothy Spall facts. He loves boats. He's got a big family. He's not a massive fan about talking about this because it's something that happened a while ago. But he's also had extreme weight loss. He used to be sort of quite a cuddly actor, and then he lost a lot of weight, and a lot of the press made a big deal of it. This is perhaps aligned to the fact that when he was 39, he was diagnosed with leukemia and had a real battle on his hands. And I think perhaps lazy journalists connected the two, even though they were decades apart. Nonetheless, doesn't change the fact that he is a brilliant guest. So he's on the way, and I just need to tell you, next week, I have the most awesome conversation on the way with one Jason Fox, Foxy from SAS Who Dares Wins. He'll be talking about his new show, and in particular, we'll be talking about his relationship with the brilliant Rob Delaney. So I can't wait for you to hear that either. Okay, enough from me. Thank you. I hope you're following the show. I hope you're a regular listener. Please tell your friends and keep coming back for more. We really appreciate it. Here is Timothy Spall.
The Andy J Podcast.
From Quadrophenia to Alvida Zane Pett to King's Speech Harry Potter and his award-winning turn in Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner. Oh, and he's also got an OBE. My guest today is an actor of extreme distinction. I'm delighted to welcome Timothy Spall. How are you doing, Timothy?
I'm all right, Andy. Thank you. How's yourself?
Well, you know, floating along. I say that because we've had a micro chat and I happen to know that you're on your boat right now.
I am, yeah. I've escaped. I've managed to liberate our old tub, the Princess Matilda, out of its glorious old home in Ramsgate, which has been a lovely place for us to be. And then got out and took it out, brought it round the English Channel and up the Thames. And that's what we're poodling about on doing at the moment.
What a wonderful life. I mean, that just sounds glorious.
Well, I suppose that is a word for it. Yeah. I mean, when it's not playing up the, what's it, sometimes, you know, boat, thing about boats is they are glorious when they're glorious. And when they're not, they're a massive, arseache.
So what's it like for you? I mean, how long have you been on the boat? Because you're basically living on it for the time being.
No. I mean, it's a boat we've had for a long time. It's quite well known for being a boat that we made the documentary series about called The Voyages of the Princess Matilda, you know, Somewhere at Sea and various things. And we just did that by accident, because we were doing it anyway. We've had this for 17 years. We had it commissioned, and it's named after our eldest granddaughter, who is 17, and it was conceived the same time she was, evidently. And it, when you've got a boat that's 17 years old and a granddaughter, and an eldest granddaughter, one of seven is 17, it means you're getting on, mate.
Well, I hear what you're saying. You're only 64, though, Timothy. I mean, to be fair, to have a 17-year-old granddaughter at 64, that's quite young. I mean, you were quite young grandparents.
That's not a lyric in the Beatles song, is it?
No, it's not. Well, listen, I have a follow-up question for you, Timothy. If your boat is named after your first grandchild, how do you follow that? Because she's not your only grandchild, is she?
I've got seven.
Yeah. So does that mean you've got six more boats?
No, I don't intend to have six more. No, I'm afraid they haven't been attached to anything like that yet. We'll have to dream something up. They're just sitting with their own names without being anointed with they haven't had the metaphorical champagne smashed with their name on it against anything. But we'll work on it.
You're going to have to get thinking. A great man once said to me, if you plan to have kids, never buy a Rolex. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because if you have more than one, you'll need more than one Rolex.
That's a good point. Yeah, that is goods and chattels and all that and leaving things. And, you know, when you get older and it's like we've been married 40 years this next month. And, so when I buy a present for my wife, particularly if it's jewellery or something like that, I'm thinking, who's going to get that? who's going to have their eyes on that?
Who will it suit most? Yeah. What are you doing for the 40th? This is a landmark. I mean, that's a huge anniversary.
It's a ruby wedding anniversary, isn't it? I know it's what the ancient people used to have. It's like something from the past, thinking, oh my God, they made it. How can you live that long to be married to those people? I've been married for 40 years. But I don't know yet. I mean, we've done enough events. I don't know, we might be quiet. I don't know. We tend to sort of do it. We'll see what happens. We haven't got anything remarkable. We might just come back on this and pootle about a bit on the water. I don't know. We're working on it. So it's, as I say, there's no grand designs.
You'll be able to help me with this, Timothy. My Cockney rhyming slang is atrocious, but isn't a ruby a curry?
It is. A Ruby Murray. Yeah. And, Ruby Murray, I don't think she's got anything to do with curry, was a singer. I don't know. If you look her up on your you work for radio, I'm sure you can press a button and her name will come up.
I can.
And she's like a famous singer. And now she's been attached to, she's now become, as you say, Cockney Rhyming's name for a curry. At least her name lives on, but I don't know whether that leads to people listening to her music. They certainly don't play her music often in many tandoori.
That's very true. But I'm just wondering if that could be a fusion for your ruby wedding anniversary. You could just fill it with curry.
What a good idea. And there might have to be rubies bobbling about in it.
There you go.
I'm going to see if next Indian restaurant I go into, I'm going to suggest they do a Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan Ruby Murray mix and see how that comes out.
I love it. Let me know how you get on, will you? That sounds an adventure.
Very, very badly.
Timothy, how aware are you? Because obviously you've mentioned the 40th wedding anniversary is looming. You've mentioned you've got a 17-year-old granddaughter and then six other grandchildren. You're only 64, as I've mentioned. How aware are you of age? Do you feel like a man who should have seven grandchildren and a 40th wedding anniversary?
No, I don't really feel that much different. Actually, when I was about, let me think, nine? I mean, I might be rising up to sort of quite a precocious 11-year-old emotionally and intellectually. I don't know. I mean, age is a funny thing, isn't it? You know, you gather wisdom, you gather experience, and you've got a whole lagoon of experience and things to draw upon. But fundamentally, you don't really feel that different in yourself. Obviously, you've got to be a bit careful about jumping about, you know, and leaping. You realize actually that your how you feel is your spirit and your physicality are two different things. Mm. So, one, you know, you have to bear in mind that you've got to be careful sometimes. But I am, you know, I'm all right. I don't do any particularly exercise. I don't do anything that has a form or a structure as exercise. It's just quite, you know, active, get about a bit, walk a lot, and you know, I do stuff. I've never felt really like fit anyway. So actually, I've in all my life, now in the last 10 years or 7 years, I felt really good, you know, because I lost a lot of weight and 7 years ago, and I changed my lifestyle, started living a healthier lifestyle. So I actually, you know, I feel pretty good and have done for the last 7 years.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that's been well documented, Timothy, so I don't want to kind of tread the same really path
boring.
As... Yes, well,
very boring.
Well, no, you lost weight. Well done. People lose weight, yeah, but, you know...
Not this morning, you know, but 7 years ago.
Exactly. Well, it's not a new story for you, and it's not exactly a new story for human beings. People lose weight all the time. The only thing I'm interested in it, because I believe you cut out booze and sugar, which is fair enough. I mean, whatever works for you. But
I don't think sugar. I mean, just, you know, I just eat really well, and I don't do anything. I don't follow any plans. I just go, oh, that's better for you. That's good. That's light. And all these things that, you know, are good for you, if they're well cooked, they're really good.
Yeah, they work. They work. Am I right saying the catalyst for this, Timothy? And again, I don't want to dwell on weight loss because, as I say, it's been well documented. You're probably bored senseless of talking about it. But the trigger for it was, is this right? Was exhaustion.
Yeah, I think it was exhaustion and a long period of work. And it was around just after Mr. Turner, which was a big, big deal. You know, I worked on that on and off for about, you know, 3 years, really. I mean, the film itself took a year, as they always do, really, with Mike Lee. They usually take about 6-7 months to make and then use a lot of preparation. And before that, I learned to paint, and now I've ended up becoming a painter now because I just recently had an exhibition in a West End gallery. So that was a weird thing, you know. So it was a big moment in my life, that hard work, a lot of research, and a massively stressful shooting schedule. And I thought, my God, I don't feel right. You know, I've got to do something. So I just stopped. I just, I decided. I thought I wanted to lose some weight for the next part anyway, so I stopped drinking, and then I quite liked that. I thought, oh, this is all right. And then I stopped eating all the wrong things, and then I was it's just stuck. It was like a natural thing. It wasn't that rigorous, do you know what I mean? And profound. It just happened, and it worked, and I stuck to it. And of course, you've got to stick to it. You know, that's one of them things. That's the age-old thing, is losing and getting on with it. You've got to keep to it. Because it, you know, the great thing about, you know, booze and food is the reason we eat and drink a lot of it is because it's really nice.
Yeah, because it tastes great. Yeah, that's the thing.
You know, that is one of the things. You know, that kind of indulgence is a wonderful thing until it bites you. And then so that's it in a nutshell, really. And I've stuck with it, and I intend to keep it up. You know.
I mean, you wear it well, without sounding like I'm flirting with you, Timothy. You know, in the latest...
Oh, darling, flirting with you. No, I mean, what was really good is that there was a sort of segue into changing shape. There was no big, there was no big readjustment required as far as my career. I didn't have to go around, you know, all of a sudden, I was playing different parts, probably different parts that I wouldn't have got before. I don't know, you know, so, and I might have lost some other, I don't know, but it seemed to be seamless, which I'm really grateful for, you know, you know, this, like this part I'm playing at the moment in the Grand Duke of Corsica is probably a part that might not have come my way if I'd been a certain shape. I don't know, you know, and other parts that I've played, you know, the part in Spencer I'm in, you know, you don't know. It's hard to say. And I gave a thought to it, but mercifully I didn't have to give too much because they kept putting up with me. They kept, as I say, in my career, I've been indulged and I've been indulged in on a long-term basis, you know, by tolerated even my career over a long-term basis. And it seems to continue.
Well, I rather thought you'd be humble, Timothy, but let's be fair. You say you're indulged. I would suggest it's more talent without. And you've got talent in abundance. And I'm assuming this is something you've been acutely aware of from day one, really, because you started acting very young, didn't you?
Well, I went to RADA in 1976, and then I came out in 78, and I've been acting since I went there at 19 and I started at 21. So, yeah, people start earlier. I've been at it. What's that? That makes 78 now. That's 40, blimey, that's 40, that's 43, 4 years, isn't it? Good God.
Yeah,
a long time, isn't it? But, well, I can't remember what your original question was earlier. Do forgive me.
That's all right. I was merely saying how talented you are. Let's go back to the start, Timothy.
You know, I suppose I don't know that. It's not for me to decide about that. You'd hope that there was something there that keeps you going. And, you know, and there's a compulsion that must be driven by something to keep doing something as ridiculous as acting. You know, this desire to want to play other human beings and try and investigate people's internal emotional and intellectual poetry. Oh, highfalutin. But yeah. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, but it's true that, I mean, it sounds a bit, you know, pretentious, but it is true. I'm fascinated by what goes on in other people's lives, whatever they do. You know, I'm really fascinated what makes people tick. And I have been since I was a kid, I think, in an instinctive way, in an undemonstrable way, you know. And now I'm demonstrating it by I suppose I had to demonstrate it in a way by this compulsion to want to be an actor, which is an affliction more than a choice, you know.
Well, let's talk about childhood, because I must say, you know, when you look at your sort of beginnings, the fact that you're the third of four boys and so on, you were brought up, I believe, on a council estate in Battersea. And in the early days, you didn't have a bathroom, you didn't have central heating. You know, these as you look out your window as a sort of 7-year-old boy, you're not really thinking to yourself.
Sounds like a Hovis advert, doesn't it? Sounds like a Hovis advert.
I was sorry about that. But the point is,
didn't have a bathroom, the top of our wheel on a bike.
Yeah, but you know what I'm getting at, though, Timothy. You know, you're not the sort of character at that sort of age. You're not sort of thinking someday, you know, you'll be in Hollywood and you'll be winning awards and you'll be an OBE. You're sort of, I mean this in the nicest possible way. I think you've said it in a previous interview. You know, it's the sort of upbringing where people expect you to go into a trade or something, not be a lovey.
Yeah, no, there was more of, yes, that was more prevalent in amongst the people that I went to school with. I mean, I happen to have my parents were both lovely, you know, individuals. My dad was a scaffolder when I was born and then became a postman and then a postal clerk. And my mum, when I was born, as I've said this before, was actually, you know, housewife, but working in a chip shop, not when I was born. The point was I was born at home.
That would have been impressive. Yeah,
I wasn't dropped into the hot fat. No, but she was, you know, she taught herself hairdressing and then did hairdressing in our house and then got a little shop and then was also a sang, you know, was had a lovely voice and sang in at pubs sometimes and then, and then she won a talent contest at Butlin. So there's a little bit of that. And her dad, who was a Times, worked for the Times newspaper all his life started out as a postboy, then ended up as a sales rep, you know, going around sending all the newspapers in the city mainly. Mm. this is 8 years, years ago, you know, before the war and after the war. So he was also, he did a bit of, he and the mate, and they did a bit of sort of entertaining as well, you know. So there was a little bit of a strain in it. So we were very, you know, from very ordinary background, but there was a slight sort of nod towards it, you know what I mean? So it wasn't completely bizarre. Although my mum, you know, she wanted to go to, she had aspirations when she was a girl to go to RADA, which was the only drama school that you'd really heard of at the time. But her father had to point out it was out of the question because he knew he couldn't afford it, you know. And it just, it wasn't something that you did unless you were very, very lucky, you know, that in the 19, you know, early 40s, you know, late 40s, early 50s. It wasn't something she could, you know, that was it going to ever happen. And she got married very young anyway, you know. She had my oldest brother at 19, you know. So it was, you know, she got on with it in that way. It was more of a fantasy than a reality, you know.
Yes, yes. Do you think that's one of the reasons why she was so encouraging of you?
Yeah, yes, indeed. I think when I, you know, when I did all of a sudden pop up and show a bit of a spark, it was, you know, she and I decided, my drama teacher, Helena Meyers, who to this day we remain enormously grateful. I just played The Lion in The Wizard of Oz in the school play, and it had gone well. And she said, you know, she was helping me take my lion's nose off, believe it or not. I played Lion in The Wizard of Oz. And she said, I've never said this to any of my pupils before because it's a horrible business, but I think you should be an actor. And I thought, my goodness me. Yeah. And it was almost a light went off, like, a, you know, my tiny little universe shifted, and all of a sudden it made absolute sense, you know. And she said, I shall, you know, point you in the right direction if I can. And she thought it would be a good idea if I did, because I failed all my O-levels and A-levels apart from art. So she said, I think maybe you should go and do some A-level, O-levels elsewhere. And then she found this place that did a drama course and O-levels at the same time. I dumped the O-level side after a while and just stuck with the drama. And then when I was 19, at 18, I joined the National Youth Theatre, 17 actually. And then at 19, I got into RADA myself. Mm. And I was over the moon, you know, and my dad. And they were very willing to contribute. I got a grant from the GLC for the pay for the fees, and then they contributed some subsistence for me as well. So, you know, it was with their support, of course, and it was and I think she was just so pleased because it was like something that she, you know, as I say, was a fantasy, a desire, and I managed to do it. You know?
Yes, yes, and what a moment for your teacher to sort of suggest that to you. That, I mean, that's going out on a limb on her part, but she must have just thought, this boy is that good, he's got to do
well,
it.
When I think of it back then, it was kind of risky, wasn't it? You know, for her to suggest it, knowing how you know, shark infested that whole world, but she must have had an idea that there was a big chance. And you know, thank you, Helena, if you're listening, and I've never managed to get hold of her. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it kind of worked out.
It sure did. I bet she's watched everything you've done with such pride.
Well, it's none of my love, and I hope if she has and she's still around and listening, or somebody does know her, give her my love and thanks.
Yeah, I mean, that's a life-changing moment, Timothy, and wow, thank goodness she did it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and then I, you know, it was funny to discover, you know, as well, that, and then I did the, I can never remember if I did that, and then I played Alfred Pete Doolittle in the My Fair Lady at school, and then I ended up in the National Youth Theatre and ended up playing Falstaff. I'd never done Shakespeare at school, and all of a sudden I was in Henry the Fourth Part One playing Falstaff, thinking, what the hell is this all about?
That's a big role. Know, so
it's a wonderful part, and it's, you know, and it's, you know, it's Elizabethan language, and I, so I, you know, I'd had this. So I subsequently went on to be completely educated by the privilege of my profession. You know, I went to RADA, I played, did Shakespeare, Gorky, Chekhov, Beaumarchais, and amazing writers, and introduced to a whole world of English literature that I'd not, in a sense, I'd come to fresh and pure from a practical point of view, you know. So I didn't have any hang-ups about it. I didn't have any sense of boredom about having any structure about language. I just discovered it and was able to learn in a very practical, hands-on way. Sometimes that's the best way, I think. You know, you have to learn quick and work it out yourself.
Yes, you were like a clean page, weren't you, for the text, for the teachers? It must have been remarkable for them, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember when I was at RADA, I did this part in a Arnold Wesker play. I did play these two parts very early on. I'd only been at RADA for about 4 months. And the great thing about RADA then was then they got you out. Hugh Crutwell, who was the principal, his idea was to get actors in front of an audience, quick, a paying audience, to let them learn on the job. So we did an Arnold Wesker play in which I played a Geordie union leader, middle-aged, and a middle-aged Tory cabinet minister, two double parts. And I did these two parts, and I even borrowed an old sort of slightly posh-looking jacket of my dad, sort of a safari coat for the tour, and then I got another old jacket. I don't remember what I did, and I just managed to cobble together a Geordie accent and then did this very, kind of Etonian type character. And I was like 20, well, I must have been 19, yeah. And I remember one of the voice teachers saying, that was rather good. How on earth he didn't mean to be patronizing. How did you know about these characters? I suppose I've been watching telly since I was born. So, I mean, it was interesting and I remember thinking, well, actually, in retrospect, how did I know? Because I've certainly not hadn't met any Conservative ministers, already Geordie, any Geordie union leaders. That had been a route for me to observe the world through television. So I'd always had a very inquisitive mind. And also I read quite a lot, I picked up, I had a magpie like mine. So I was very inquisitive, and I do remember kind of coming up and working on these parts, thinking, actually, I do this. Talk like this, Andy, I can kind of get a character going. And then I talk a bit like that. I sort of worked it out. And then these characters, and I started thinking about where they're from, what they're like as human beings. And all of a sudden, I thought, I think I can probably do this. It was really like that, Wow. It was quite a sort of interesting exercise, it's one of them things you don't know you can do it until you do it,
yes. And is that something that continues to be part of the appeal for you, because you are a big researcher, you do the work into the characters before just kind of showing up on set, don't you?
Yeah, I think about it a lot, and I think, as I said, television as a kid was a big obviously an influence on the eye on the world, but also I think having an inflamed imagination really helps to be an actor, because you have to think, you have to really think out of the box and imagine, empathize, as it were. And that's come in good stead with me in my career as well, because I often have to play either really lovely, charming characters or sometimes unpalatable ones, characters that were a little bit unpleasant.
Yes.
It's great to get this, have this ability to really work out, and understand even people who are, traditionally unpleasant have a story to tell, that they were a babe in arms, that they walked about, they were probably tickled under the chin and their mother loved them, or maybe didn't. Maybe that's the reason why they're unpleasant. Or whatever. You've got to think about these things. And just the flight of imagination, what you can't find out from fact or what might be true. You have to imagine it, you know, and that's, I think that is, imagination is a big part of the whole part of the toolbox, you know.
Hello, it's John Markar here from our sister podcast, The Driven Chat Podcast. Right now, you're listening to The Andy J Podcast, and it's quite good, isn't it? In fact, do me a favour, give it a little review, 5 stars, and wherever you're listening, hit that little subscribe or follow button, because it does help. See you around.
The Andy J Podcast.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, your body of work is significant, Timothy. I mean, if we were to list every movie going, you wouldn't get a chance to speak for this hour because you've been in so much. But when it comes to researching for movies, because I know the audience will be fascinated by this, like you say, you've had a huge breadth of roles. You aren't typecast. You know, there isn't a sort of, oh, he always plays lawyers or whatever it might be. You play such a sweep of different things. What is the approach? Do you get to meet the authors? Do you get sent on, like if you're, I don't know, we often heard people in ER, for example, would actually be sent to the emergency rooms for a while to kind of observe. Does that really happen? Do you really get sort of training before you perform?
It depends on the job and the time frame and the budget half the time. You know, one of the things about working with Mike Lee is that that is an integral part of the job, you know, that you... because you start with no script, and the script is evolved out of the research and out of group improvisations and so on. Quite a complicated and complex individual process that Mike Lee has totally individually invented himself. But it does involve a huge amount of detailed investigation from day one, what the person was like from day one to the point you're about to play them. So you have to really do go and research. And if they have a job, you know, that you go and learn about that job. You know, I've played like a high street photographer. I've played a chef with Mike. I've played a musical singer. I've played a taxi driver. And so you go and do these things. You go and actually... not live that life, but go and, you know, I spent a lot of time with photographers, high street photographers. You know, I didn't drive a taxi, but I
was about to say, who did you pick up in the cab? That would have been fun.
Well, in the back of enough, and I can drive a car. But and this character played the taxi driver was a bit of a sort of lost soul anyway, you know. That really literally, you know, you invent an entire parallel universe when you work with Mike Lee. Even now, when Brenda and I did Secrets and Lies, which was one of his most, you know, successful films, which, you know, garnered all sorts of Oscar nominations and stuff.
Yeah, after and everything, yeah.
Brenda and I played brother and sister, and, you know, there's still a doorway on the Woolworth Road. When I drive past it, I think, oh, that's where our doctor's is there. And of course it isn't. It was actually the doctor, it's our character's doctor, in, you know, which we talked about for ages. You know, you really do go into this. But anyway, as I say, that's with Mike Lee, that you don't often get that luxury. But what that has done, that discipline and that that technique, and always done it to a certain degree, it always makes me want to find out more, to invent things, to, depending on the time, to ponder what people are like, where they live, what their circumstances are, what they are like before they turn up in that scene and what they're going to do after that scene. Mm. Even when I did the school play, I must have been 16 when I played Alfred P. Doolittle, and I read in the script, Alfred P. Doolittle lives in a tenement in Tottenham Court Road. So I got on a tube and I went and walked around and tried to find tenements in Tottenham Court Road. Of course, there weren't any, but I looked around and I could see sort of feel the ghost of it and think, actually, this is, yeah, I could see him walking down here. So I was kind of doing it, you know. So the suits, it kind of suited me, really, when I ended up working with Mike. And I've done like 7 things with him, you know. And it's culminating with Mr. Turner, which was the kind of one that did, you know, in a sense, was a big career thing for me as well, you know.
Best actor at Cannes. I mean, that's huge.
Well, it was, yeah, that was nice. That was a very nice experience.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. So, Yeah, so I'm just waffling on here. I can't remember I've lost my train of thought.
No, getting into characters. I mean, Timothy, you've done so much, and there are certain people I know will be listening for certain movies. So I'm going to have to pick out a few. You'll sure. know what's coming. I hope you don't mind. But then there's a whole load of other questions I have for you about yourself, and of course the Grand Duke of Corsica. But let's start with the big franchise, because you've done a few. We'll start off with Harry Potter. Where you, obviously Peter Pettigrew / Wormtail, I mean, what a character to be handed the sort of task of occupying that one.
Yeah, I mean it's funny. He's also got another name, because I sometimes have to write him down. He's Peter Pettigrew, Wormtail, and Scabbers.
yes, that's fair.
Free for the price of one. But that was very, very interesting thing that came along. I mean, it's actually and I don't want to sound arrogant here, but it's one of the smallest parts I've ever played in a film, but also one of the most most internationally well known. It's very bizarre. But of course, that's one of those. I hadn't read the books when this came my way, and I said to my kids who were reading it, I said, what's this character, Peter? I said to my youngest, Sadie, I said, what's this? She's about 16 then, I think, maybe 15. What's this character, Peter? Why are you asking? I said, I've been asked to play it. Have you? Yeah, he's great. And then I told my kid brother, that, and him and his partner, they were reading it and said, oh, you've got to do that,
That so turned out to be strong advice.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, then I found out that I went to meet Alfonso Cuarón, who was directing that, who's gone on to win everything since then,
He's
a lovely guy as well. And I met him. I had such a great interview. And he also told me that David Thewlis and Gary Oldman were playing the other two parts. And of course, the great Alan Rickman. So that was the first thing I was going to be in. I thought, oh, this is interesting.
Yes.
And all the contemporaries, and I knew them all, and they were all brilliant. So this is all seeming like a prospect I can't turn down. And then, of course, it started to become apparent to me how much people loved these books. I mean, what a big deal this was. And, it was... And of course, the first one had already been made, and this was the second one, I seem to think. Yeah. It was the second one, wasn't it?
Yes, and, it was,
it was gathering this almost religious sort of status, of people being really adoring it. And then I did it, and I enjoyed it. Alfonso was a brilliant director, and those other actors that were contemporaries of mine, we had and then getting on that set and realizing that the amount of craft and detail that was going on around it, the hordes of immensely talented technical designers and prop man, lighting man, cameraman. I mean, it was like, and then going into being sort of escorted into this room that somebody said, do you want to come and have a look at Hogwarts? And being taken into this studio with this amazing model of Hogwarts that had been built,
Yes.
And I saw somebody putting individual leaves on the trees that were all like actually models, bonsai oak trees. I mean, it was unbelievable the quality of, the attention to detail that were going into that and the skill, So that was the great thing about it. And then turning up in the morning and there'd be some, British movie or theatre icon having a false ear all stuck on or an eyeball screwed in. some night of the realm. Morning, how's it going? Oh, I'm just having my eyeball screwed in, Then it becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And then the wonderful thing about that, of course, is apart from how excellent how people catch on to it and how much they love the whole thing, is the fact that it gets kids interested in writing and reading,
yes,
you know?
Yes, absolutely.
They read. Become this amazing, you know, spark for kids to read, to pick up books and read them, which is brilliant, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. No, I mean, it's a franchise. I mean, Harry Potter World is still one of the most sort of popular visits in the UK. It's incredible. It's amazing how well it's done. Another one I have to talk to you about was what it was like working alongside Tom Cruise, which, of course, you did for Vanilla Sky. I mean, he's an icon, isn't he?
Yeah, Vanilla Sky and The Last Samurai.
Yes.
I did two films of him. Yeah. Oh, he's lovely. He's a great guy. I really liked him, you know. And you know, two things you want to know about Tom is he's a really lovely guy, very, very, very kind and lovely man. And also, you know, when you think of it, to be, you know, at the top for nearly 30 years now, and to remain like that, you know, at that position, still making, you know, those films and still turning out these amazing, you know, products of brilliant films and varied.
Mm.
That's a remarkable thing. That's the devotion to knowing what entertainment is and never shortchanging your fans and making films. You know, he produces a lot of them. You know, he's actually, you know, is a really, a, you know, he ultimately employs hundreds of people, you know, directly and inadvertently, you know. I mean, he's a great, you know, great character, great modern Hollywood character, you know. And also, you know, very, very, very fine actor. And I'm here to say it once again, a very, very, very nice man.
Yes, I'm amazed he's never had a proper award. You know, I always kind of think to myself, look at the roles he's played and the franchises, the money his movies have made. You know, that's because he's beloved and he's terrific at what he does. It always surprises me that he doesn't, you know, he doesn't sort of always grace the award ceremonies. You know, it's just, why not? What's going on there?
Well, you'll often find that that's the case, you know, that people who are purveyors, you know, constantly doing it. They don't, you know, Hitchcock never got an Oscar, did he, until the end. You know, it doesn't work just the way it does go sometimes, you know. You know, he's also, another reason that he's so, you know, successful is he keeps his eye close to the ground. He's always interested. I remember when I worked with him, first time I ever worked with him, I was working with Danny Boyle on a TV thing. This is, he was just about to do 28 Days, I think.
Just before,
you know, and Tom, you know, it was only a TV, like a BBC Two TV thing called Vacuuming Completely Nude in Paradise, it was called, that Danny was doing.
What a name, brilliant.
Jim Cartwright, yeah, Jim Cartwright. And Tom was just really interested in, because I had to get back to, they worked out the dates, you know, there was always a thing that I needed to get back. He was just intrigued about, you know, about Danny Boyle and what, you know, he was just interested in what was going on. He just keep, who's coming up, who are the talented directors, who are the good writers, you know, they're very, you know, that was the thing, those little forays into Hollywood I have had. Well, I'm always impressed by how knowledgeable and how, you know, contrary to popular opinion, they're not completely wrapped up with themselves. They're very interested in other people's works and what else you've done. They have a huge breadth of knowledge of film in general, you know, current and past, and that's how they keep where they are. They're very interested, you know.
Yes. Yes, I mean, Tom's work ethic is sort of renowned as being incredible. I love the idea, you've sort of called him a lovely man a couple of times. Timothy, I love the idea that you guys maybe have a text relationship or something where you send each other comedy gifts for birthdays and things. Are you still in touch?
No, I'm not. No, but, you know, I always, every time I've bumped into him over the years occasionally, and it's always been very pleasant. No, I don't. No, we don't have a textual epistle.
Oh, that's a shame. maybe for the next movie.
Isn't it? I'm sorry, Tom Cruise, and I do not have a textual epistle.
That should be the title of his autobiography. I think that would... That'll be a lot of fun. I'm gonna stop kind of naming films at you in, after this last one, because we've got so much more to discuss, Timothy. But I remember talking to Michael Sheen about the responsibilities he felt when he was playing a real life character, a real person who he might have even met or rubbed shoulders with or was just very aware of. And of course, in The King's Speech, you had the lofty responsibility of portraying Winston Churchill. Now, what was that like?
Well, it was a challenge. Yeah, I mean, and I'm not the first by any stretch of the imagination. There are brilliant people who have done it before me and have done it since. So there's all that. But you take on an icon like that, right? And there are so many, different opinions and feelings about him, and you know. And obviously he's worshipped and adored by most and some not, you know. Mm. But mostly he is one of the great, great characters of the last 100 years. You know, that's within doubt. But, you know, I take it on the same way as I take on anything, you know. I think, you know, there is a lot of material that you can, you can draw from. There's lots of footage of him. And there's lots of literature about him. So you read, and also what I do is I look and I listen. I had to listen to him. I listened to his speeches. Were amazing. That was a great experience over and over again. And yes. Just the full speeches, you know, not just the highlights, and to get the hairs on the back of your neck going up about this amazing power, this almost this war machine of language that he was able to use, you know, and then think about his past and what he was, where he's from, and what he was like physically, and what he was like in his quiet moments. You know, it's only a cameo in that film, really. But you try and bring as much detail to it as you can. You know, there's the physical attributes, and then there's all the stuff underneath it. It's the same with any character, whether it be an icon like Winston Churchill or a kind of slightly hapless taxi driver. I always think your responsibility as a performer is to dig deep and just try and give as many layers as you can, and hopefully not let anybody think that I'll see you doing it. Really, just turn up as the character. You know,
brilliant. Yeah, what an approach. I love it. And didn't I mean, this might be my brain, so apologies, Timothy, I often get things wrong, but I seem to remember the 2012 Olympic ceremony, you showed up as Winston again then, didn't you?
I did. I was asked to do that, and I popped out the top of Big Ben.
Yes, that's right.
that was an interesting experience. I had to climb up there and crouch down in there, and all the thing, and it was live, and I made the mistake of asking the director. I just said, he was a charming fella, I said, just as a matter of interest, how many in the audience? He said, 80,000. and then he said, and about a billion are watching on live. wish I hadn't asked that, you know? Julian Lloyd Webber was down. I think he was popping out of St Paul's Cathedral on another clip, and backstage. I remember backstage was an amazing experience because there was the Spice Girls doing an a cappella version of What I Want, What I Really Really Want, and there was the Who riffing in another dressing room, and then Julian Webber doing a bit of Dvorak, all practicing. And then an opera singer. I mean, it was like an unbelievable thing. You know, it was just the whole thing was a remarkable experience and quite nerve wracking.
Yes, I bet, especially when you've had that billion number drop into your head, you can't not constantly focus on that.
No, I think somebody said not quite as many as the opening, and that was no comfort to me.
And also,
it was not only doing Churchill, but Churchill doing Caliban from the Tempest. You know, that was So how can I pull this off? The cheek of it is outrageous.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's testament to how well you're regarded, though, Timothy. So I love that. Right, look, I'm desperate to talk about The Grand Duke of Corsica because I watched it last night and I've got so much to ask you about it. But again, there is one more story that I need to address with you, which I hope you don't mind. I'm acutely aware of our time as well. And this is the health challenges, 1996, when you were 39 and you were told that you had acute myeloid leukemia. I mean, holy moly, that must have stopped you in your tracks.
It literally did, of course, acute myeloid leukemia, It was, it was, you know, one of the worst things, if not the worst thing I've ever heard, you know. It was a terrible, terrible moment. Mercifully, with great skill and great love, my wife, and particularly my kids, my family and friends, I got through, you know. I've often said that, you know, it's, goodwill and medical expertise and love was got me through. It's not something, being a sort of, one of the, well, at the time, a sort of a hypochondriac, it wasn't the one I saw coming, so it was a terrible, terrible moment. And for a long time afterwards, 5 or 6 years, it felt like something that was happening to me. But then, like all these things, you get by, you get through them, and then, you have a certain period where you're told, if you get through the first 5 years, you're unlikely to relapse. There were a couple of dodgy moments in it where I thought I had, but I hadn't, thank God. And then now it's 23, 24 years ago, so it's something that happened. It was an awful period, but one that, in the long run, I think, I wouldn't advise it as an aid memoir to making you understand better or making you a better actor, but it certainly, I think, gives you a deeper understanding of what it's like to have a bit of suffering in your life, put it that way.
Right. Yes. It's like these light bulb moments you've discussed historically, usually linked to good things. This is a slightly different one.
Well, yeah, and I think, I've always been a huge accentuator of the positive. I think, all the old cliches, what don't kill you makes you stronger and blah, 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 unless it maims you, in which case it makes you weaker. It doesn't. It doesn't work on that one, does it? But but it can make you mentally strong. And these things do, they do add, just another layer, just another stitch in the old bloody tapestry of what goes on in your life, and you take it forth, and and hopefully it certainly makes you grateful for the advances in medical expertise and the skill and kindness of doctors and the love of your family and friends, but it also hopefully it gives you, it turns up the old ratchet on the humility, and a sense of importance about things. And, I didn't want to make a big deal about the fact that you have to suffer when you're ill, but I think when you do, and God bless people who are, I think you realise that there is a shared thing, to have a taste of it yourself, there are people suffering, and it's a good thing to know what that, what a lot of people are going through in one form or another. And, obviously, as you get through it, you go and it becomes the past. But it's something that a humbling experience.
Yes. Well, thank goodness it is just a memory now, because that cannot have been a nice time in your life. Right.
So, it also gives you a great zest for life. You go on with it, and then it gives you a great barometer on what is and what isn't important, what you should, how much time you have, and how much you've got to do, and not to don't let fear hold you back,
Yeah, that's a really, really important thing to actually to grasp, isn't it? Because life is short, and some people don't realise it. It's almost like when a youngster's just been taught to drive, they sort of think they're invincible. They think that the thing they're driving is damage proof until they have a crash, and then they realise, oh, hang on, I should probably slow down a bit. It's the sort of medical version of that.
Well, yeah, I think you, life is a myriad of experiences, you know, and you either learn from them or you don't, you know. And I think if you try and accentuate the positive, and it's very, very hard for people who, you know, who have terrible experiences and can't get over it, and I understand that. But, you know, it's like anything. I think you have to constantly try and, you know, accentuate the positive, you know, cast out any resentments and things like that. But it's difficult. And I know it's not easy for people to say when they haven't got these things, things they can't shed. But I think, you know, it's like the pandemic was an interesting thing, wasn't it? How that brought out the negative and the positive in aspects of life and in individuals. It was a remarkable grouped and shared experience, you know. And I don't know whether I'm imagining it, but since, you know, things have started to get back to a modicum of normal, being out and doing things like boating and being around, I think there seems to be a lot more calmness and kindness about it. Could just be my hopeless sort of optimism, but it seems to me that the world has taken a breath. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And had a think. I might be wrong, but it seems like it has. You know, I'd like to think so, but then again, you know, maybe I'm just an optimistic fool. You know.
Well, I think some people have realised that actually they'd taken a lot of things for granted, and when they were removed, they're delighted that they've been restored. So I think some people absolutely have learnt a humility and an appreciation as a result of the pandemic. Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's, but again,
yeah, and to be working actually where the normal has become extraordinary. It's become, you know, who would have thought that the normal, that drudgery, would have become something that you were after again? You know,
yeah,
that you would remove from your, you know. So it's an interest. It's been an interesting interest. See how it lasts.
Yes.
What the next is, please God, let it be a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because we've had the Great Reset. Now then, The Grand Duke of Corsica, the new movie. You're playing Alfred Rott, who's a genius architect with bad guts and a potty mouth, shall we say.
Description.
Yes. I have to say, I really enjoyed this movie. And Timothy, if I can be sort of really blunt to start with, the title, I wasn't excited about watching it. The Grand Duke of Corsica, it didn't sort of grip me. I was sort of thinking to myself, oh, okay, this is going to be powdered wigs and period costumes. So the minute you appear on the steps, everything changed for me and I was absolutely hooked.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, that's great to know. It is a slightly odd title, isn't it? It had an odder one at first, and that was called The Obscure Life of the Grand Duke of Corsica.
Yes.
So they... So it has got it's been shaved down a little bit. No, I see what you mean. No, it could be construed as some lost restoration play that's been turned into something, couldn't it? It's a very, very unusual and textured story, I think, and it goes off in various different tangents, and which comes back and winds its way back to the same idea. And this character, Alfred Rott, is such a wonderful, unashamedly cantankerous and unpleasant at times character who has an experience again that, even in his, at a point of his career, again, takes him on a journey, you know, that he wasn't expecting, and an unlikely result friendship with this bizarre man who he'd usually want to throw out of a window, let alone get to know, you know.
Yes, I mean, your character arc was wonderful, and I thought to myself, I bet you loved playing this role because he's such an interesting and curious individual.
Yeah, no, he is, because he is, I often don't get the chance to play somebody who is so rude, you know.
He really is rude, yeah.
Really, really rude and kind of, you know, there are those people who wake up waiting to be annoyed, you know. Relishing the prospect of being annoyed is one of them, you know. And I think that's because he's because he's a sort of a genius, and he's also run out of patience with the people who are employing him half the time. You know, he's this brilliant architect. He can't stand to be messed about with and people to make him compromise. You know, he's an uncompromising character. And so he finds himself in Malta, and he finds himself about to do this job which goes badly, and then he finds himself on this very bizarre journey, being sucked into the world of this very unusual man, this self-appointed character who, of course, is known as the Grand Duke of Corsica. You know, I won't give too much away, it's this bizarre billionaire who lives in this weird castle that he goes to see, and he doesn't really, he's not that, you know, he's one of them people immediately that he doesn't really take to, you know. He thinks he's going to be another, it's just going to be another exercise in being, you know, meeting somebody who is just going to drive him mad. Unusually, it doesn't work out like that. It does at first, but the character is so compelling and so strange and wild and mad that they form this odd alliance. I mean, this journey, obviously, he ends up going to this bizarre kind of high class sort of upper management type of, you know, corporate sex sort of party that he doesn't like, and then he ends up, you know, goes to jazz. He always ends up having an argument with people.
Yes, he does.
But this bizarre relationship in shoes of this man, who I said who's played by the wonderful Peter Stolomori, they form this odd friendship, you know, because he's got to build this. He gets a commission to build this. To build a mausoleum for him, you know, which is something that he's never been asked to do before. And then there's these bizarre, it's very unusual subplot with Francis of Assisi, with these questions of mortality and sainthood and him saving a leper, that all inform this kind of bizarre inspiration for him to build this very unusual, extraordinary sort of Philip Stark type, Frank Gehry sort of type sculptural thing, where this character can reside for all eternity and become immortal by becoming a tree.
Yes. Yeah, a peach tree. I must say, I loved the finished product. I thought the design was great. I was really impressed. But I mean, similarly, you know, the movie visually, I mean, like you said, there's a heck of a lot going on, and there's all these sort of random timeline jumps and these tangents, and there's pandemics and malaria epidemic and all kinds of other things happening. But actually, the central point of the movie is your dynamic, the relationship between yourself and this wild billionaire. And it's absolutely captivating, and it looks stunning. Daniel Graham's the director, isn't it? And wow. I mean, it's really gorgeous to look at.
Yeah. No, it's in the sort of style of those great, you know, people have been comparing it to Peter Greenaway and things like that, and saying that they're similar, those great visual feasts where the place is as much and the atmosphere is as much as the story, as the tale is. So you get this peek into this world where it forms its own sort of world where you're sucked into it, you know, this extraordinary parallel sort of universe that these people exist in, you know. Mm-hmm. And this oddly prescient, this was written, you know, two years before the pandemic was ever, you know, it was a blink in anybody's eye. It was coincidental that, you know, that slowly but surely the backdrop for this thing is revealed as this very, very, awful, strong, life-threatening strain of malaria that people are just dropping all over the place. He eventually, you know, he finds himself having to finish this bizarre mausoleum as he's building this friendship with this strange man, you know, in an island that's being you know, under attack by this pandemic, this disease. You know, it was very, very oddly, you know, as I say, prescient. You know.
Yeah. No, it must have been. Must have been fascinating, actually. So sort of reading the script at the time when it was all happening, and then to film it, presumably under some COVID regulation restrictions and so on as well.
No, we didn't. It wasn't. It was completely and utterly coincidental. This was before. This was about 6 months ago. The pandemic wasn't even dreamed of. No one saw it coming. This was about. Coming on 2 years ago, I think maybe 18 months ago, it's taken time for it to come out because of the pandemic.
Gosh.
No, there was absolutely nothing. It was totally and utterly coincidental.
Oh, that's bonkers. Wow.
It is. I couldn't believe it. I remember getting, talking to the producer about this afterwards when, you know, it was about 6 months afterwards that this happened. It was like, my goodness me, this is a, because I always thought this is a bit outlandish, this part of the plot, you know.
Yeah.
I thought part of the plot, this pandemic happening. I thought, will people buy this? Surely this will never happen. Why? You know, it's the one of the strains in the plot that is the most relevant, in a sense, you know. And of course, some critics have accused it of being opportunism. It's absolutely not. It's more of a more of a prediction than opportunism.
That is bonkers. I thought it'd been like added in afterwards. I just sort of thought, oh, okay, well, they've added in a pandemic plot because, you know, that's what the public know right now. But if beforehand, me.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was probably written 18 months before we shot it. So about 3 years before the pandemic. Yeah, no doubt about it. I can absolutely give you that. Horse's mouth, and that is true, totally true.
Wow, can you get the lottery numbers as well? Because this guy, he knows his stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and Malta, there's something about Malta, that's why a lot of people film there. It's got a wonderful light, you know, as well, and this fantastic architecture. There's a real ancient quality to it. There's a kind of odd magic about it. You know, it's close enough to Africa to be, it's Europe, but it's close enough to Africa to have a kind of mysticism about it. And, you know, everybody's been there from the Knights Templars to the Moors. It's a wonderful feeling in that place that can produce, you know, this beautiful light in these buildings. But, you know, I'm really pleased you liked it a lot because it is an unusual film. And it also has, you know, it's funny and it's bizarre, but it also has these themes in it. You know, films to me, what I love about being in different films and different styles is they're like paintings, you know. Some are obvious, you read them and you look at them and you go, oh, you know what that's about, like this film, the Last Bus I've just done about an old man on his at the end of his life taking this journey of the past. That's like a painting, like a Victorian painting that you saw, and this is much more like an expressionist painting, like a bizarre mixture of things that are little signs in it that you have to work out, some obvious sides and some not, you know. And Spencer, the movie that I'm in, which is this classic tale of a, you know, like a bizarre fable about Princess Diana, they're all like, it's like being in, you know, that's what they're called, moving pictures. Yeah. Some films are, you know, obvious, some are mysterious, and that's what's great about it, to be in such diverse work. And you know, this the Grand Duke of Corsica has a real, you know, real originality to it, and I'm glad I've got the opportunity to say that side of it, you know, the pandemic side, which could seem like you know, well, let's bung it in, it's not, it's actually a prediction.
I mean, yeah, that's spun me out even more. I think I'm going to have to rewatch it now with that in mind, because that's, terrific. Wow. I mean, Timothy, wow, you've been such brilliant company. Thank you very much for your time today. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Pleasure to talk to you. And I'm about to start my engine and get on with my river trip.
Sounds like a wonderful afternoon. Brilliant. Timothy, enjoy yourself. Thank you so much for the chat, and I sincerely hope we get to talk again in the future.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Andy. All the very best.
Brilliant. Take care. The Andy J Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.